Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Everybody, Tom Woods here. Welcome back to The Tom Woods Show, episode 2417. I don't know what I feel like I have to prove here, Clint, churning these things out. But here we are. I'm very glad to be joined by Clint Russell of Liberty Lockdown, who has just, you know, I know I've talked about this the last time you and I talked, but like a rocket just catapulted out of nowhere and now is like a central figure in our circle. So, Clint, welcome to the show.
Sir Woods, my liege, I'm at your service. Yeah, thank you so much for the invite back.
Well, you're a good man. You know, when you produce all these episodes, I was doing it 5 days a week for a while. I used to be super sensitive to make them all as evergreen as possible. Sometimes I do current events, but I want people to be able to go back and listen to episode 507 if they want to, and it's still got something fresh to say to them. But I'm not sure that's been the best approach, because I don't know how many people go back and actually listen to episode 507. By the way, I don't know what episode 507 is, but they're all good. They're all worth listening to. But today I thought I have been diving a little bit more into current events, and sometimes from 1,000 feet in the air. So like, for instance, I had a guy on a couple of weeks ago talking about the theology behind the rapture and Christians in Israel and the Jewish people in the end times and all that, because people have been kind of hinting at that, but nobody that I've seen has actually delved into it in a whole episode. So sometimes instead of just doing the little details of what's going on day to day, sometimes I'm trying to look at the bigger picture. But today, let's get into the nitty gritty. Let's go into some detail. So first of all, in order to situate the kinds of questions I want to ask you, how would you describe yourself, like, philosophically? And has that changed at all over the past few years? And this is a safe space, Clint. You can say anything you want.
I don't think that I've evolved dramatically in terms of ideology or philosophy. I just realized a hell of a lot more people don't share my beliefs than I thought.
Yeah.
I think that was the major change, is that, like, I was a much more optimistic about humanity type of person. And now I'm a little bit less so. However, I've also had, you know, such an incredible change in my life trajectory where I'm interacting with so many more people that do share my values. So, and I'm also seeing enormous audiences for discussions that would have never received the types of audiences that they get today. So I think that there is a sign that more and more people are interested in our belief system and what we have to say. And, you know, libertarian anarcho-capitalism, that's broadly what I'm talking about. Non-interventionism, that's also one that I thought we had woken up the MAGA crowd on with the America First spiel, and now Israel struck and suddenly that's out the window. So it's a teeter-totter. I go through optimistic and pessimistic phases, but in terms of actually changing my belief system, I don't think it's changed tremendously.
Well, I think your answer is exactly the way I'm thinking, because you're right, especially after COVID, I realized that things that I just assumed everybody would agree with me on, I get not everybody's on board with privatizing the lighthouses, Clint, you know, fair enough. But even when I would present the most reasonable, obviously reasonable stuff that I believe in, even that is being met with skepticism. And after years of being told crazy and counterproductive and idiotic things, they still want to honor Dr. Fauci. I can't help those people.
No.
But you're right that at the same time, there are definitely more people than ever asking the right questions. So that sometimes that comment section drives you to despair. But other times, that comment section makes you think, wow, absolutely nobody who really thinks about things is going for Nikki Haley. You know, absolutely nobody is believing this story that, I forget the name of the Pfizer head, but you know who I mean. He puts
Albert
a tweet
Borla
out, he doesn't even dare allow comments, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I guess that has to be some source of encouragement.
Absolutely. Yeah, Albert Borla, I believe, is the CEO that you're referencing for Pfizer. Yeah, look, I think that in many ways, like, especially in the Twitter world, for whatever reason, it feels like we kind of dominate, which is fascinating, because I don't know any other area of life that we dominate.
That's right. I'll take it.
Yeah. But we have one arena where we seem to be very successful. And, you know, I think that there's also, you know, particularly my generation and younger, like the people that actually fought in the war on terror, many of them, even if they come from a more Republican or even an evangelical backdrop, they're just done with this. Like, they realize that they've been deceived so much when it comes to the propaganda to get them into the wars that many of them fought in, or they at least had a relative that fought in, that they're far more skeptical of the propaganda push for the next good war, the next moral war. And I think that that's fantastic progress. Obviously, I wish it was going a little bit faster, seeing as there's multiple fronts for World War that are potentially in the offing. But I think if you look at the recruitment rates for the military, if you see how neocons that try to run for president are abused and laughed off the stage largely, Vivek Ramaswamy, who I just interviewed again with Luke Rutkowski last week, we got him the day after he was on that debate stage just blasting Nikki Haley and DeSantis and Christie and everybody else that wants to see eternal war. You know, whether you believe Vivek is the real deal or not, I love it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I love to see neocons just scolded.
And what matters, again, because I get people saying, well, I don't trust him because of this, or I don't like him because of that. But the real story here is there's somebody who thinks it's to his advantage to say these things.
Exactly.
You know, that's the interesting thing. You know, on the issue of military recruitment and stuff, I sometimes feel like, I don't think they're doing this on purpose, but it's a side benefit to the regime that almost everybody knows somebody in the military. You got somebody in your extended family who's in it or has been in it, or your next door neighbor or your coworker or whatever. And so that pulls you in, I think, to it makes it harder for you to stand up against it all, to be a full-fledged dissident on it, because you kind of identify with the military. Oh, my old friend Joe is in there. And right. And so it's made it hard for people to see these things clearly. Now, on Veterans Day, I didn't try this out yet, Clint. I don't know why. It's not that old Woods is getting soft here, but you know how everybody's always saying, thank you for your service? My line is, you're welcome for my tax dollars. Now, I didn't try that out on Veterans Day, but next year, that's the line.
Well, I wish you well in that. You know, I grew up in San Diego, for those that aren't familiar. And, you know, I lived right next to Camp Pendleton, which has lots of Marines and military veterans broadly all throughout San Diego. Tons, Navy, everything. Played beach volleyball with a bunch of these guys. And, I mean, they're really good people. So I really go out of my way not to offend these guys, because ultimately, like, if we end up in some sort of hot conflict domestically, like, I hope that these guys will be on the side of good. So I'm like, hey, you're trained killers. Could just remember, I didn't spit on you when you came back from Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or Lebanon, or, you know, the list goes on and on, or the Mediterranean or Gaza, wherever they're fighting today surreptitiously. But yeah. I do understand the sentiment that also I'm being robbed to pay for their bloodshed, and that's not
very
fun.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and the thing is, I'm of two minds about that too, because I've had a lot of people, as Scott Horton has, write to me and say, I got discharged from the military, I was able to get status as a conscientious objector or whatever because I listened to you. And if I had said to them, you're all pieces of, you know, right?
Right.
Then I think it would have been less likely they'd listen to me. So that's kind of why I hesitate with stuff like that. I mean, I don't really hesitate to speak my mind, but sometimes I want some things to be heard by some people, some things to be heard by others. You know, the other day I was feeling very sentimental, and we have a group chat on our phones with all the daughters who have phones and my wife and me. And I sent them a link to a Ron Paul compilation video from about, I guess, 11 years ago. No, well, longer than that. It was from the 2008 campaign. Hmm. And I know that's a long time ago and things are different now, but I'll put it in the description of the video. It's a compilation. A lot of people were making Ron Paul compilation videos in those days. They'd take snippets from the debates or things he said in interviews or whatever, and they'd put them together. This one, it probably only got like 35,000 views, but it always really moved me because it had Bryan Adams singing "Can't Stop This Thing We Started."
Hmm.
It showed all these people endorsing him. It was all positive, pictures of us all happy together, cheering for him. I mean, it almost brought a tear to my eye because I really remember thinking in those days, even though, you know, I guess my brain was telling me they'll never let this guy win or the people aren't ready for this message, but my heart felt like something was happening. You know, something was really happening. And it's sad to me that I don't have that feeling anymore. Were you around for the Ron Paul years?
Oh, yeah, big time. I was, I don't know, 25 years old or something like that when 08 was happening, and it was incredible. I mean, for those that don't know, I'm actually a second generation libertarian. I was raised into this. So for me, it was like all of these taboo concepts were suddenly palatable on a grand scale. And I was just like, I had gone through my entire life just arguing with everyone I know about everything and no one agreeing with me about anything. And then all of a sudden it was like, I have a tribe. It felt so good, which is weird because, you know, as an individualist, I'm kind of accustomed to just being a lone wolf. But Yeah. I mean, 08 and 12, that 5-year run was just as fulfilling, as spiritually engaging an era as I've ever existed in. Next to maybe this one, because I'm now able to talk to, you know, my heroes and do all sorts of cool stuff. I mean, I spoke on the DC steps with Ron Paul just in January. So it's like, I ought to feel as if this era is even more hopeful. But the reality is that I really thought that he had a shot of getting in there. As delusional as that seems in hindsight, I really thought he had a shot.
Well, I think it was that the sheer enthusiasm that our side had couldn't be matched by anybody. Nobody was even going to cross the street for Mitt Romney. But you got people with Ron Paul signs out in New Hampshire with 2 feet of snow, or Michael Maresco riding his bike across the length of the United States, passing out Ron Paul literature. And I know people looked at him and thought, isn't it great that a cyclist like this would do this? But that was the thing. He wasn't a cyclist. He was just a guy who bought a bike. And because that's how strongly he felt about it. And then when John McCain was getting the coronation from the Republican convention, Ron Paul does the impossible. All the hotel rooms are taken. All the rental cars are taken. There's nowhere for anybody to go. He holds it. He didn't call it this, but I'm calling it this. He holds a counter convention. They were in St. Paul. He was in Minneapolis that same week. And somehow we coordinated. We got 10,000 people at that Target Center in Minneapolis, basically by saying, look, I got a couch you can sleep on, or I've got this or that. And we made it work somehow. Nobody else was going to do that. And so I think we thought, because there's so much enthusiasm, the people we see, each one of them probably represents 100 other people. Right. But I think the people we saw were all the voters, basically.
I think there was more than that, but not
but
as many.
But you know what I mean? Like, there wasn't, I think when you found out about Ron Paul, you didn't want to sit on the sidelines like you would with Rick Santorum or something.
Absolutely.
You wanted to get out there and do something.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, he was as inspirational. It's funny because he's such a relatively subdued guy.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, country bumpkin professorial almost. And you're like, this guy led a revolution? And you're like, yeah, he did. I was there. I was 25. It was insane.
Yeah.
It's just, I think the timing and the messenger just aligned, it collided with itself. But yeah, I remember just watching these montages, and you're right. It was just like nothing but viral Ron Paul clips all throughout the internet for all those years. It was just amazing. So many of my friends who, I mean, it's funny because, like, even though I'm accustomed to just holding ideas that no one else shares to a large extent, there is just something about like the social proofing aspect of these messages being viral and seeing college kids chant them and having people that are just broadly discussing topics that I've cared about for a very long time, that allowed the average person, the non-political type, to start to hear me more clearly. It really did. Like, I don't know if it wrote an entirely new chapter in the book, but it definitely turned the page over to a new chapter for us to work on in terms of the dialogue with our fellow men.
Well, as long as we're on the Ron Paul subject and you've been talking about war, might as well bring it up. I had Vivek on the night before the debate.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And I asked him about what's his opinion of AIPAC. And I think he sidestepped that one, and probably wisely. He said, I haven't had any interaction with them, so I can't say. Well, okay, I haven't had any interaction with them either, but I can still say, you know what I mean?
I still have a lot to say about it.
I have plenty to say about a lot of people I've never interacted with. But Ron Paul shows that it is not inconceivable that you can stand up to them and live to tell the tale. Because he didn't go for any of their propaganda for the entire, all the 11 terms he was in office. And he just said, I believe in non-intervention. I don't believe in foreign aid. And that's the end of the conversation. And you can call me any name you want to, but those are my principles. So it can be done. And, mm-hmm. and in particular, I think now with, even before this whole war broke out, there was a lot of negative attention all of a sudden being cast on the ADL because of their confrontation with Elon Musk. And they're not accustomed to that. I don't think they're accustomed to having to turn off replies on Twitter. They're the ones who are supposed to make us all terrified and say what they want us to say. But all of a sudden, the tables had been turned.
Yeah, during the old ownership period of Twitter, I would block all of these accounts, because I was so afraid of them mass reporting me or just seeing something that I said that they disagreed with the sentiment, and then they sicked their bot network on you to mass report you because so many people were losing their accounts. And I don't think that I was unjustified in feeling concerned about these people in that way. They really do function in that fashion. It's fascinating because, you know, the ADL leads with a message of historical persecution. What happened to the Jewish people, or what happened to this minority class, or whatever? But then they persecute people very viciously. And I think that's actually a good analogy for what's transpiring in Gaza right now, is that this historically oppressed people, which I will grant, Jewish people with pogroms and the Holocaust and everything else, terrible, terrible amounts of persecution for hundreds of years. But it doesn't change the fact that they're now persecuting lots of innocent women and children, lots, and ending their lives viciously. And I don't even want to apply this to the Jewish people. I'll just say, you know, Israel, IDF, whatever, just to make it more specific. But there is something fascinating about, once you feel righteously aggrieved, what sort of just horrific violence is able to be brought to bear without any sort of consideration. And I think that's what happened after, you know, October 7th, is that, yes, righteously aggrieved. Still, as a non-interventionist and as an anti-war libertarian, I still will speak up for the innocents that are caught up in the crossfire of two warring tribes. And it's heartbreaking to witness. Sorry, I don't even know where we started with that question, but
I was talking about AIPAC and the ADL. And
oh, yes.
That suddenly it's increasingly possible to resist them. But, like, for example, Thomas Massie, you saw, was being attacked by them.
Yes.
They were calling him an anti-Semite. They're going to run ads against him. And he stood up and said, look, that stuff doesn't work on this congressman. And I thought, I just needed to hear those words from somebody.
Yes, me too. That's why he is Ron Paul 2.0 from the congressional level. I think he's as close to Ron as we've seen. And let's just be honest, if you're going against Massie, you're definitely on the wrong side of history. This guy is true blue. His principles are crystal clear. And, you know, to accuse him of anti-Semitism because he's not going to go along with more military funding is just laughable.
Time for a quick message from our sponsor, Cheeky Maiden Soap. Now, if you could break into my house, which I strongly discourage, by the way, you would find Cheeky Maiden Soap products in my bathroom. And I've been using them for at least several years now. Now, why is that? Well, natural soaps like the ones Cheeky Maiden makes are typically made with organic ingredients like plant oils, essential oils, and herbs. So you're avoiding synthetic chemicals and potential irritants found in industrial soaps. In fact, just try to pronounce half the ingredients in those industrial soaps. You sure that's how you want to treat your skin? And here are a few, by the way. Now, I think in grabbing a few of them just now, I think I grabbed the most effeminate sounding ones, but I promise, if you need to have soap that's in more of a lumberjack style, they can fix you up with that also. So I got some chai latte soap right here. Lavender soap, I'm not ashamed to tell you, I enjoy that one also. Energizing soap, who couldn't use some of that? Their soaps contain nourishing ingredients that help hydrate and moisturize my skin. They leave it feeling soft and smooth. And natural soaps are often milder and gentler on the skin compared to their industrial counterparts. They don't strip away your skin's natural oils or cause dryness or irritation. Well, it's easier than ever to be like Woods because you know me, you now get a discount. Go to CheekyMaidenSoap.com and use code WOODS15 at checkout to save 15% off your next order. That's CheekyMaidenSoap.com and use code WOODS15 to take 15% off your next order. I can't remember the guy's name, but I follow a lot of people on Twitter because of COVID. And then now I'm kind of having buyer's remorse. Who are these people I followed? You know, they were good on one thing, it turned out. He's a doctor, and I can't think of his name, but somewhere buried in my Twitter feed, I responded to this guy because he tweeted something along the lines of, it was a pro-Israel tweet, and he was saying something along the lines of, after 9/11, Americans didn't say, well, we better try to be surgical and proportional, whatever. Maybe you saw this tweet?
Oh, I saw it. I forget the doctor's name, but
yeah,
it was hysterical.
And I responded, I wish we had. Wouldn't that have been great instead of acting like complete idiots and morons for 20 years and bankrupting ourselves and then being worse off than when we started? Wouldn't it have been better?
Obviously. I mean, that's what's so frustrating about this. The corollary to the war on terror and the 9/11 attacks are striking, to put it mildly, in terms of questions about early warning signs and reaction times, and then the immediate response of, well, yeah, we were attacked by Hamas, but it's obviously Iranian proxies that are destroying, that are attacking American troops all throughout the Middle East. And I'm like, well, maybe, but I don't believe you people. You've lied to me my entire life. Why would I possibly believe that? And they never even feel as if it's necessary to proffer any evidence. It's just like, yeah, we had some troops that were at our camp in Syria. Oh, we have a camp in Syria. Why? Why do we have a camp in Syria? Oh, there was also an attack from Iranian proxies against our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Why? Why are they there? Why? Why is what? Can we have that discussion? We're just gonna brush over that. Oh, would you like any evidence? Could you offer me any proof that Iran is funding all of this? That they're funding Hamas? You have a full blockade on Gaza. You have a full blockade. Nothing gets in or out without the approval of the IDF. And you're going to tell me that they're receiving all of their funds? No, it's actually through the Qataris. Well, but also Netanyahu funded Hamas through these cutouts because they wanted to prevent a two-state solution. It's like, it's all so complicated, and they try desperately to portray it in this black and white, you're with us or against us, you're on the side of evil or you're on the side of good. It's just not that way. It's not the truth, and it wasn't the truth after 9/11 when it came to Saddam Hussein. And I assure you, a year, 2 years from now, we'll look back at this period and we'll realize we were deceived tremendously once again.
I want to ask you something else that comes up a lot in our circles, and that has to do with political action. Now, you know that we have people who think either it's immoral to be involved in politics because you are thereby, quote, consenting to the system, or it's a waste of time and you should be engaged instead in educational efforts. I think my thinking on this has definitely evolved over time. We'll put it that way. Where are you on this?
I waver, man. Just to be straight with you, I don't know. I think that if the LP is to exist, then it's, you know, on the federal level, I think that the primary funding ought to go to the presidential candidate, because I think that gives you the greatest opportunity for waking people up, you know, and I think that's a really important thing. However, with the advent of the internet and social media and the capacity for viral messaging outside of political debates and things like that, like actual presidential debates, I'm not so sure that it's necessary, or it's not as necessary as it once was. Like back in 08, when Ron was running, even though he ran under the GOP, it was still like, that was the only time you were really going to be able to get that message to the normies. And now Glenn Beck will invite us on, you know, Tim Pool, Rogan, there's a whole bunch of platforms that are inviting people with our belief system on. And so I'm not so sure. I still believe that local action is ultimately where we're headed, and it's where it's most, you know, fruitful and most necessary. So I think that the broad Mises Caucus plan of, you know, decentralized revolution is probably the trajectory. The problem is that I don't find that messaging to be very compelling, you know, even though I believe in it. There's just something about it that, like, decentralized revolution is like, that's just boring. Like, I know, like, you're including revolution, which is a fun, cool word, and then you're like decentralized, and it's like wonky, you know, accountant talk. So I don't know. I go back and forth. Where are you at?
Well, I never really went for the it's immoral to vote, because I don't think that's true. Oh, yeah, I mean, no. Lysander Spooner didn't think it was immoral to vote, and no, I don't think
self-defense.
We're taking his libertarian card away. What'd you say?
It's self-defense, in my opinion.
Self-defense, yeah, exactly. That was his argument, that if you're doing it, like if you're in a concentration camp, and I say, all right, and I'm the concentration camp guard, and I say, we're going to have a vote, and we're going to vote on whether you eat steak or gruel. Well, I'm voting. I'm going to vote for steak. You know, I'm
sure.
Yeah, oh, I'm consenting to the system. No, you know what I'm actually doing? I'm making my life better. That's what I'm doing. I'm not consenting to anything. This is the situation I find myself in. Or if we're going to have a vote, whether we're going to let you out or not. Are you saying that on principle, I'm going to vote to stay in the concentration camp so that I won't consent to the system by voting? This is ridiculous. You know, so get out of that. If you don't want to vote, don't. But don't give me this whole, it is not immoral.
Yeah.
Because you are not, it's the left-wing idea that you're consenting to everything by casting your vote. We're against that. We don't believe that that's true. But the other thing is, in terms of it being a waste of time, the thing is, I've never heard it explained to me. And I've asked Michael Malice, who wrote a whole article for The Observer about what a waste of time it is to vote. I've asked all these people I respect. Well, then what's your scenario by which we get from here to there? And I have agorists in my audience, and I love that strategy too, and you can pursue that. But
sure.
What's the pathway? And I never really get an answer that, well, eventually people will learn enough that something will happen. That's just not specific enough for me. And that's not to say that, you know, the Republican Party is going to be your savior, but at least on some things, as Rothbard said, on some things, there was no way that simple civil disobedience was ever going to solve the problem. To get the Second Bank of the United States shut down, you needed the president to not renew the charter. You know, like there are certain things that you had to, if you were going to get around tariffs, like in England, well, you needed the repeal of the corn laws. You know, like there's some things required political action.
Yeah. I feel like Malice and many in the, you know, hardline anarchist camp are essentially like waiting for the Berlin Wall to come down. Like they're waiting for the USSR to just implode upon itself. And obviously the analogy being that America will be the next communist empire to collapse. And maybe, you know, but like the reality is everyone I know and love practically lives here. And I am very, very concerned about what an outright collapse looks like.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very, very concerned about what hyperinflation would mean to everyone I know and love. It would be devastating. And it doesn't matter that I've told them about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like, it just simply doesn't matter. So this is why I always get frustrated with people that limit our options, or they say, oh, no, you shouldn't be doing that. You should be doing this. I don't know what the answer is. If I knew what the answer is, we probably would have already won. Okay. So like I am a, you know, shotgun blast of a different attempts and different pathways, different avenues, different mediums. I think it's just all hands on deck. Everybody that, whatever you're best at, whatever you're most passionate about, go do that as passionately and as beautifully as you possibly can. And if that's getting people to vote, if that's running for city council, if it's running for your sheriff, please be a sheriff. Oh my goodness. I would love that. I would love to go live in your town. If it's running for president, like whatever it is, if you're great at it, please, we need everybody participating.
What would you say you're most disappointed about when it comes to the libertarian world right now?
Oof, man. I mean, honestly, from my vantage point, it's just the politics, you know, which is a weird thing to say because I'm talking about a political party. But, you know, I'm friends with so many of the people that are involved in this at the highest level.
Well, it doesn't have to be the LP. It can be just a broad movement, all the libertarians out there.
Yeah, I mean, the infighting is obviously very frustrating. The constant, like, purity testing for, you know, I did a debate a couple days ago, and they were applying purity testing when it came to my belief in, there's a bunch of Afghanistan refugees that have been pushed into Pakistan, and Pakistan is now pushing them back out. And the person I was debating was like, well, you know, Pakistan hasn't properly homesteaded all of that land, so they can't really, you know, justifiably under a libertarian framework evict these people from Pakistan. And I was like, wait. We're going to apply homesteading rules and laws and principles to Pakistan's response to the migration of 1.7 million Afghanistans thanks to the American empire. And we're not going to talk from an American libertarian vantage point. We're not going to focus on the American empire destroying Afghanistan and driving these people there. We're going to actually critique their immigration policies. That's the, you know, it's just like, it's just the minutiae. It's like people are, some about our capacity to understand these concepts makes us incapable of messaging them in an effective way. And I know that's very frustrating to me.
Do you think when you hear a libertarian say the right is just as bad as the left, that that's an accurate message?
No, definitely not. I think they both have the same capacity for badness. But at this current junction, no, I think it's totally delusional to think that the right is just as bad as the left. The left, over the past 12 years or so since the woke mind virus took over, I think is an existential threat to me and my family, for sure. So, yeah, I mean, the right can obviously get indoctrinated into advocating for military intervention against Hamas. Like that could happen, and that'd be terrible. So I'm not turning my back and being like, you're an ally I can trust for sure. But as far as like the most dangerous, I think that the left is the clear and present danger right now.
How about this? What do you think libertarianism is wrong about, or if not wrong, has not reckoned with enough, that maybe hasn't paid enough attention to? Yeah, this is a tricky one. This is like, these are some rough questions here, Clint.
I know. Yeah, well, I love it. Put me through the
Well, if you want, gamut. I'll give you my answer.
Yeah, please.
Okay, so one possible answer, I think there are several, but one possible answer is, I think we were too glib about the distinction between the public sector and the private sector, that the private sector, everything will all work out because of competition. So if there's a terrible employer, well, don't worry, the good employer will attract all the workers away from them. And the real enemy you have to focus on is the public sector, and that's where all the badness is going to come from. But I think we've seen that in the private sector, there are some, I should have seen this before, but there really are some rotten employers whose rotten behavior does not seem to be corrected by the market. And that could be whether it's the vaccine policy or firing you for saying something that's obviously true or whatever. Now, I don't exactly know what the solution to that is, but I definitely know we weren't talking enough about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of the ESG DEI framework, which is largely led into by government regulation. So it's a distinction without a difference. The private industry and public is like, it's very hard to delineate at this point. So I think that's the one thing that what you're absolutely right about is like to blanket defend private enterprise is a huge mistake because the vast majority of them at the highest levels, they're not really functioning from a private enterprise level. You know, like it's just not reality at this point. Unfortunately, I wish it were, but it's not. I think that we're oftentimes, I shouldn't say, you know, broadly the libertarians, but I think that we were wrong about the amount of debt that the nation could take on. But I think that there's a good reason for it. And an Austrian economics, you know, explanation for it is that we were exporting our inflation to the rest of the world as the dollar reserve currency. But I think what makes it very unique is that when that reverses, when the US dollar reserve status is threatened sincerely by the BRICS alliance, I think that it will expedite our demise. So it's like, it's going to be a bang moment. And a lot of people who have been predicting things, Peter Schiff comes to mind, shout out to Peter, that have been saying, it's next year, and they just keep saying it. I think that they will eventually be right, and it is going to be very rapid, but I think we've been wrong about the amount of debt that a dollar reserve nation can accumulate before that happens.
All right, I'm going to try to steel man a position here and see what your response is. So let's say I'm a well-meaning conservative, like not an idiot. I'm not a Mitch McConnell guy. I more or less see the world clearly, but I've got some blind spots. And I approach you, Clint Russell, and I say, you and I have a lot in common, and we definitely feel put upon by the same bad guys. And so where possible, we should try to see where we can work together. Let's say this person even says, now I will grant you that my Republican Party is still full of Mitt Romney people. It's still full of fund the Ukrainians people, full of these people who are going to have the wrong position on a lot of things, who are going to have the wrong position even on the most obvious things. We have people who are going to stab you in the back all day long, but we still do have a rising group that nevertheless is a bunch of dissenters from this. We do have some, we at least have an increasing constituency of people who are starting to see the world more clearly. Now, they're not great on everything. They're going to be China war hawks, just even though they're good on other things, they won't be good on this. But I think some of the party is moving in the right direction. And this is a time when we can't afford to indulge in this vanity project of voting for some ideologically pure libertarian candidate when the future of our kids' souls hangs in the balance. So can't you just drop this vanity project and try and work with the best people we have in the Republican Party to try to salvage something?
Yeah, honestly, it's a fair argument to make. I don't think it's an unfair one, but the truth is that just as in a free market, without competition, your quality of service declines and the cost of it increases. I mean, that's just what happens. It's a monopoly practices. Basically, for the liberty-minded amongst us in America, the GOP has a monopoly on voting for freedom, and they don't deliver freedom. It's a terrible product. So I want to have more competitors that I can actually send my dollars to and receive some of my liberty. So this is the primary argument that I have for why it's important that there is more than a GOP option for peace and freedom. Because the truth is, GOP doesn't deliver that. They deliver record, budget deficits, and they also deliver, you know, as many wars as the Democrats do historically, it seems. So, yeah, I think that that's, well, I do understand the argument. I think that it's flawed because if you don't hold their feet to the fire, they're not going to do a damn thing for you.
Everybody, quick message on behalf of our sponsor, Monetary Metals. You have almost certainly heard Ron Paul say that the thing that got him into politics was Richard Nixon closing the gold window in 1971. And ever since Nixon definitively took us off the gold standard, things have just gotten worse. The dollar has lost over 90% of its value since that time. It's become harder for Americans to retire. The national debt just surpassed $33 trillion. Disaster can strike at any time. And so we need a change. Where's that change going to come from? Not from DC. It has to come from the market. We need a market-based answer to the corrupt, dishonest money we use today. And I think we have one. That answer is Monetary Metals. Monetary Metals enables you to get on your own personal gold standard starting today. Who cares what the Federal Reserve is doing with interest rates when you can earn interest on your gold paid in gold? Earn up to 5% in their gold leasing program or earn double-digit returns in their gold bonds if you're an accredited investor. I've put my own money, my gold, where my mouth is and opened an account with them myself. It's time for you to do the same. Join me and our old friend Jeff Deist as we lead an honest money revolution that starts by opening an account at Monetary Metals today. Go to monetary-metals.com/woods to learn more. That's monetary-metals.com/woods. Last thing that's on my mind, and I ask you this just because you and I follow current events closely, and I think, you know, each of us has as plausible likelihood of knowing the answer as anyone. It seems pretty likely to me that within a matter of, I don't know how many months, Trump will be a convicted felon. And it'll be for something dumb that, you know, no normal person cares about, and it's a kangaroo court. We all know that, and I have no argument with that. The problem is the people who are so dedicated to either Trump or bust don't seem to understand that most of the country thinks being a convicted felon is bad. They're not going to listen to your nuanced explanation about, well, they're actually all against him because of this, that, and the other thing. They don't like convicted felons, especially independent voters. And they need independent voters. The Trump base is not big enough to win. And so it doesn't matter what the polls show now. Once he becomes a convicted felon, it becomes very, very difficult for him. Not just because of that albatross, but also because he'll be tied up legally in all kinds of ways. There are all kinds of things they could do to him to make it borderline impossible to campaign. So can you pull out your crystal ball and tell me, what do you think happens when Trump is a convicted felon and the likelihood of his being elected is very, very small? Do you have any thought about what the Republican Party does at that point?
I actually disagree with you on this.
Oh, please, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, maybe it's just my own bias, but like the only chance Trump has of getting my vote is if he's behind bars. That sounds awesome. I would love to vote for Trump from behind bars. Like, I want to see a guy.
Soccer moms won't though, Clint. That's my
point. I know, but there's a lot of pissed off people, Tom. There's a lot. And I think that there's a lot of people that like, they feel, even from the left, believe it or not, I think there's a lot of people on the left that see the system working against them. And like any doubt that you have about Donald Trump's legitimacy, even though like this doesn't really prove it, but it's still from the layman's perspective, it proves that he is a genuine outsider that is functioning and working against the system. And that's really appealing to people who feel as if the system is working against them. And I feel that way. And I think there's millions of people that feel that way. I mean, if you look at the polling, I'll grant you, it's before he has that felon, you know, label attached to him, but he's crushing. I mean, he's winning in all the swing states. He's beating Biden handily. So I'm not so sure. You know, I think that there are inflection points in nation's history where like trends break, like things that used to be taboo. You could never imagine. Well, you would never imagine that you'd have the leading presidential candidate under indictment facing 700 years in prison. Like there's paradigms that are shifting and breaking in real time. So I'm not at all sure that he's not electable.
Okay. You make an interesting case. It's just that the fights he'll have will be so numerous. Like the Republican Party establishment is not the same establishment that it was in 2012. Sure. And it has more Trump sympathy, more populist sympathy than it did then. But even so, I mean, can you imagine, not that Mitt Romney was going to, you know, lift much of a finger to campaign for Trump, but But a guy who's on the fence might say, well, what do you seriously expect me to do? I'm a respectable businessman, and you want me to go around donating to and publicly supporting a guy in prison? I can't do that. So I think he's going to fight against the Republican Party. It's going to, who knows?
Well, I just think that, like, there's such a desire to see, you know, that desire that got Trump elected in the first place, the wrench, the bull in the china shop, that instinct is still there, and it's probably increased a lot. Like, here's the truth. If you're an average guy who's looking at Joe Biden as the option, assuming he's still the candidate, which I think is a distinct possibility, he will not be. I think Gavin Newsom's the odds-on favorite. But the truth is, your life has gotten exponentially more challenging since Joe Biden's become president, just because of the inflationary pressures. Not to mention that hundreds of thousands of people that had their, you know, I don't know if they lost their jobs, but certainly had their jobs jeopardized with the vaccine mandates, which was a Biden directive. So I think that there's a lot of people that are just going to look at it and say, whatever, I don't care. Like, they may, you may be right as far as, like, they may not publicly talk about it. They may not be sending campaign funds. They may not be going out on the stage and speaking for him. But I think there's a huge percentage of people, especially if the options are Biden versus Trump, they're going to say, screw it, I'm pulling the lever for Trump. And let me also say, if it's Gavin Newsom, as a California refugee, I am so mortified at that guy having a shot at ruling over this nation that, like, I would probably have to, like, actually get out and campaign for Donald Trump. Gavin Newsom is Satan reincarnate. He is one of the worst human beings on the planet, maybe in human history. He is so dangerous. I have to, every time I get an opportunity, to emphasize this to people, because I really think he's got a shot at being the next president. You have to do everything in your power to keep him from being the president of the United States. He is so, so dangerous. He will ruin this country if it's not already ruined. I'm being totally sincere about this.
It's incredible that he could be such an ego case that he could look at the state of California, the condition of this state, and say, I'm going to run on that.
Oh my God. Today he's actually, so over the past like 2 weeks, they cleaned up all of the homeless encampments and all of the syringes and everything else from the streets of San Francisco because Xi Jinping was coming to town.
Yeah.
His actual boss was showing up and he's like, we got to clean these streets out. I mean, and then he's asked about it today and he goes, you know, a lot of people think that we cleaned up these streets because, you know, we have, you know, foreign dignitaries that are coming to, yeah, you're right. You're right. He says, you're right. And he continues on. It's just incredible. I mean, these people, they just don't care at all. But the crazy thing is that they don't have to. They don't have to. There was a recall election and he won by 70% during the teeth of lockdowns when all of the businesses had been shut down and our lives were utterly ruined. He walked away with a, you know, recall election victory. So, like, don't underestimate that guy. No matter how transparently evil he is, he's got a shot.
Anytime any of these people, whether it was Whitmer or anybody else, won re-election, what did that say? That's saying, you ruined my life for no good reason, and I approve of that. Or, I'm so incurably stupid that I couldn't be bothered even to look up whether this did any good, and I just trust you because you're the person in charge. I don't know what.
When I look at the polling figures and, you know, people are like, Joe Biden is polling at the lowest percentage for any president at this point in his presidential, you know, term, whatever. And I always look at it and I'm like, 40% of people approve of this
guy? Yes, I know this figure is way too high.
It's like it ought to be two. How are there 40% of people that think that Biden's doing a good job?
Yeah, what, or 40% of people who say, this is exactly what I wanted to happen.
Oh my God, it's so crazy. So yeah, I mean, same exact sentiment. I'm trying to decide, is it Cuomo, is it Whitmer, is it Newsom, who are the worst governors on earth, certainly in America? And then they go, who are the three people that were considering replacing Biden? It's like, Cuomo, Whitmer, Newsom. I'm like, what is happening? Yeah. Why are the worst politicians actually, you know, climbing the ladder when they should be in prison? It's so infuriating.
I hear you. Clint, Liberty Lockdown, people can listen to that through any platform that they choose, I assume.
Yo, absolutely. And also, I'm doing a show over on Rumble. We Are Change, all one word, with Luke Rutkowski. We just signed an exclusive deal with Rumble. So a huge shout out to them for, you know, supporting that. And it's a in-studio show in Miami. Eventually, we'll get Tom on, I'm sure. And a bunch of other people are coming through. It's going to be basically TimCast Florida edition. It's a hell of a lot of fun, and I'm very excited about the things to come. And let me also say, this week, I will be on TimCast IRL with Dave Smith. It's going to be amazing.
Oh, that'll be great. That'll be great.
Super excited.
We'll look forward to that. And by the way, that reminds me, I only met Luke once. It was a long time ago. But I met him through the Ron Paul movement. And so I look back and I think, I met so many interesting people still, you know, in touch with today because of that.
They just keep circulating around. Yeah, no, I know. I think that's the whole argument for Dave Smith's presidential run that we were all hoping for. It was like, what those movements create is the next generation of leaders. You don't know it at the time. You don't see it coming. You don't know that the guy who's handing out flyers down at, you know, the ground zero, like Luke Rutkowski, is going to end up, you know, having an audience of hundreds of thousands or millions per month. You just never know. But that's what lighting that fire in people in their 20s and early 30s can do. It can lead to the next generation of Ron Pauls. So all hope is not lost, folks. Hang in there.
All right. That's a great message to conclude on. Thanks a million, Clint. I appreciate your time. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.